and welcome back to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. This is Retro Asylum, episode 317. Now, I know what you're thinking. Dean, wasn't there an episode released just days ago? And yes, you would be right. But just like a London bus, sometimes you can wait ages for Retro Asylum and two episodes come along at the same time. This one would have gone out slightly earlier, but got held back for the Shining Full CD episode. So, coming up in this episode, in a couple of minutes, I'll be speaking to Chris Hill of GamesYouLove.com and NumbskullDesigns.com, because we're going to be talking about a book that he and Mike Diver are working on called Coin Op to Tabletop, the Essential Electronic Games Book. Now, the reason I wanted to cover this is because before I got my Atari 2600, the majority of gaming that I'd done was on these tabletop games, such as Astro Wars, Invaders, Pac-Man, Game & Watch games, the Tomytronic stuff. I absolutely loved it, and I think a lot of people around my age, you know, would have played these and really enjoyed them. And it's not something that really gets a lot of coverage. So this book, I'm definitely interested in. The Kickstarter does finish on the 28th of October. So if you're interested in it, and you know, have a listen to what me and Chris discuss. If you like the sound of it, you need to get in there before the 28th of October. That's when it runs out. Yeah, a little bit of news quickly. Tomb Raider Unfinished Business, or Tomb Raider Gold, as it was known over in the States, has been ported to the Sega Saturn. Now, this was an expansion pack release for the PC, and as far as I know, it was never actually released on any of the home consoles. So this is the first time I've played it, and you can download this and burn it onto a CD, or, and this leads on to our next bit of news, the Sega Saturn core for the Mr. FPGA has been released, and Tomb Raider Unfinished Business, or Tomb Raider Gold, runs on it absolutely fine, or at least what I've played of it ran absolutely fine, because although the core has now been released officially, it's still work in progress. So a lot of games, there are bugs, a lot of games will not load, there's problems with it, but Tomb Raider Unfinished Business appears to be working fine. So if you never played it or you want to play it again, but this time on a Sega Saturn, it's out there. I'll put links in on the show notes where you can find it. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I've just spent an hour uploading a load of files for Mark, aka Kit, because he could never get the computer side of things running on his Mister, and he's had it for quite a while, and he's not really using it to its full potential. So yeah, I've just uploaded a load of files for him. As you know, he's got a new job, so I'm not sure when he'll get a chance to download all the stuff that I've uploaded and sort it all out, but hopefully he will have a full setup working. Anyway, guys, I'm rambling now. Let's get over to the interview with Chris Hill, and I'll speak to you soon. So, welcome to the show, Mr. Chris Hill of Games You Love. Hello, mate.
Hello, Dean. How are you doing? It's good to see you. Or
it is.
Yeah,
We've been chatting for years on and off, haven't we? Through messaging, a bit of promotion for bits and pieces that you're doing.
Definitely,
but this is the first time we've actually had you on the show. So for our listeners who don't know, can you tell me a bit about yourself and Games You Love and Numbskull?
Definitely, please. Yeah. So Games You Loved is probably a place to start, to be honest, because that led to Numbskull. And I started that up properly, I suppose, in 2012. Of all things, on a Facebook page. That's how far we're kind of going back.
Yep.
When social media, I remember being at work, getting onto this thing called Facebook in probably about 2007.
Yeah.
I think I'm right about that sort of period. And I guess I was, a lot of your listeners you know, collecting, picking things up. I think seriously, I got into picking things up around the year 2000. Weirdly, I remember going on eBay trying to buy things with my Dreamcast because I didn't have a computer.
Yeah, the old browser on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, just that sitting there waiting. It was a nightmare because you could never really do that thing at the end.
Yeah.
It took about sort of 3 minutes. Because of
the resolution
kick in
as well, yeah, didn't help, did
exactly
it?
Exactly.
Trying it to fit it all on the screen, yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of got into, you know, obviously kept some things. I've, you know, got childhood consoles and games,
yep,
but I don't know what it was. I can't remember what was the turning point. I think eBay was probably the turning point.
Yeah.
You know, somebody told me about this auction site, and then I'm looking at, you know, there's a story of I really go off on a tangent, mate, so you're going to have to stop
me.
I remember when I was, I suppose about, I think about this age-wise, 96, it's about 22, 23. This is going to shock some of your Sega fans, I'm afraid, but I was in the town centre coming back from my commute from London, and I saw this wonderful creature called Sega Saturn in Dixon's.
Yep.
And, you know, even where I live is in Wellington City, and even we had a very nice Dixon's in the town. Wish that was there now. And I just remember, like, looking at this thing, you know, thinking, wow, like 3D graphics and, you know, all the amazing launch titles that came out. So I put my money down, and I think it wasn't a launch. It was a, you know, a little way down the line.
Yeah.
Anyway, the long and the short of it was that I sold my Saturn to buy a PlayStation, you know. And you didn't regret it at the time, but obviously started to browse on eBay and saw a Saturn with, I think it was about 44 games for 100 wow quid, which is not bad, and yeah, a steering wheel, and also a video card as well.
Really?
Which is just shocking when you think. Yeah. But this is, we're talking about 23 years ago, you know.
Bargains to be had. It's funny you mention the Sega launch because I didn't have one myself, but my cousin, who I often mention on this show, Sean, he ordered one from, I think it was Great Universal, or one of the catalogues at the time,
okay,
and it turned up early. You know, we're talking maybe 3 weeks before it was actually launched, and we went into Dixon's at Moorgate in London.
Right,
and we were trying to buy some games, and they would not believe us that we had this console. My cousin actually had it in the boot of his car because he was taking it round to her friends and showed them, and they started saying, oh, you've nicked it from somewhere.
Yeah, they're so expensive. Strange offer.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the dude who bought it off me, you know, I had to sell it in the local paper, as you did back then. He turned up with his suitcase. He had a three-piece suit on because I sold it not that long after I'd bought it, you know.
Yeah.
So he had to lay down several hundred notes. It was quite funny. He came up, you know, I remember the arcades, and he was really into it, and he's sitting on the end of my bed. It's all a bit weird. around my mum and dad's house I lived at the time. And anyway, just bought it there and then cash, and I took that money and I bought myself a PlayStation. I really remember the launch game. I'm sure it was something like, might have been Ridge Racer.
Yeah.
And then obviously I went through the whole PlayStation, you know, thing. And then obviously this kind of turning point, I've got a couple of these to talk about, but, you know, it was when I went, get the Sega Saturn. I think it was a bit just before the Game Boy Advance came out. SP. I always remember things in dates with when I went and bought consoles. and then it was just this kind of, you know, I remember getting the Lynx 1 and 2, and then it was just, you know, bit by bit by bit. I mean, you know, and then obviously the 23 years of not mad collecting, but just, you know.
No, but bits and pieces, picking
exactly
them up here and there, yeah.
This here, I don't, obviously we're not sort of seeing things, but my
Vectrex he's pointing to.
And that was in a canvas bag. I'm not making all this up. 130 quid and about 10 box games, but it's the canvas bag. And the dude drove it down from Cambridge
to West
London, where I was, as part of that money as well. So again, it's just picking up those, and that's the same Vectrex I've had for, it's got over 20 years now.
Yeah.
So I was doing this, you know, like we all perhaps certainly were doing 20 years ago, a little bit disconnected with other collectors, you know, and sitting at home, started to, you know, wonder, I guess, you know, how can I get together? Then I thought, oh, shall I start a cafe? So I should have done that. Shall I, arcade club?
Yeah, could have beaten to it by, a decade or so.
It's about 2005. I thought, oh, well, let's start up a, you know, a games cafe. But the world was different back then, you know. I mean, just getting funding, the awareness. Yeah. So I just wrote it down on a pad and forgot about it. But wrote this thing down called Games Were Us. Games Were Us was the original name for Games You Loved.
Gotcha.
And then sort of sat on it for several years. Anyway, I was kind of there with my brother-in-law, who is a writer. He's a bit of a creative. And obviously my room was starting to build up. But when I think about it, it really was like a shelf and then a few bits. It really wasn't anything, I guess, you know, beyond much at all. Maybe like 10 consoles, if that. He said, what are you going to do this Games Were Us thing? You know, keep talking about it. I said, oh, you know, I might start a Facebook page. But I did a draft and it looked like the sort of front of sort of Totopoly or something, really crap. It's like a horse, because it was board games and video games, and it was like out. It was all a bit of a mess, to be honest. Lots. I was trying to do a broad thing of games, so he said, "Yeah, it's a bit of a bad name. It sounds like Toys R Us, you know, Games Were Us." Anyway, so let me have a think. And he writes pub guides now, funny enough. So he's on about his fourth book. And he came back a couple of hours later. He goes, what about Games You Loved? So it's he came up with a name. And I was like, boom, like, that's a great name.
That'll do.
And I've worked in brands marketing for my entire life. And I think when you get a name, I mean, you've got a great name, Retro Asylum or whatever it might be. And it then starts you on that journey. I rebuilt the page. I come up with a logo. I drew the logo out. It was a combination of things, a TV. The star in it, I don't know if people noticed. It's like the star off the American truck, that, you know, all sorts of things. And they come up with the brand and started up a Facebook page, basically. And when it started, you know, I had like one follower, two followers, and, you know, kind of as you always have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And then purely did Facebook for probably about, I think Twitter's probably about a year and a half. And then, you know, did the, you know, sent some people from Facebook into Twitter. And yeah, from 2012, I've had sort of people help me in and out, but predominantly it's me, for my sins, running this all. And I really enjoy it. I mean, I've met so many amazing friends through this hobby. You know, to say that you can't meet people off the internet, you obviously haven't worked or played in that, in the space of gaming. I think there's other hobbies as well, but it really is quite a big community online through Games You Love. I'm literally, I think I've met hundreds of people who I would say are my friends, you know, through when I go to Blackpool, it's like, oh, mate, you know, it's this constant thing of doing, and then going to the events, you know, that's been really,
it becomes more social
fun,
doesn't it, really, these things. When we go, we don't, obviously, we talk about some of the games and systems, but a lot of the time it's just a nice catching up with mates you've made over the years through this. You know,
absolutely.
Kind of yeah.
Absolutely. So many, podcasts and events, books, what else? Musicians. I mean, you know, it's the whole plethora of things, artists, cosplayers that have come through the different channels, and they're slightly different in terms of who's on what. There's a bit of crossover, so that's quite interesting, let alone the international side. I met John Riggs recently. That was really good fun in Norwich. That's definitely something I want to explore much further. And I always set out, funnily enough, I kind of met my dad and he said, what do you want to do if you, you know, if you get into 40 or what? I was like, I really just want to do this, like as a bit of, you know, explore where it could go. Don't have any particular goals other than one single idea, which I still stick with, which is, I didn't show my face for a while, weirdly. That was something was commented on Saturday. I was on a panel. It's like, you know, so he made the joke of his, you know, he's getting away from the logo. It's just actually showing his face because yeah. I wanted to share other people's content and be a hub, I suppose, for just anything and everything. And, you know, I wanted to share people who literally had one subscriber, you know, if they had, it wasn't going to be like, I'm only going to share the big news. It was everything and everything. I think that's how the channels have grown over the years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll do my own content. I still, you know, love kind of doing that, but I like the idea of being a producer and a curator. And that was the single idea from the beginning, really. So many amazing collections that people have got and quirky stuff that's what the channel does. You know, literally every day I see something I haven't seen before. You know, I either tagged in, a lot of people tagged, we keep our tags open because it's just more open that way to, you know, to kind of get stuff sent to us. People DM me things. And yeah, you think, like, I'm going to come on to the tabletops, but you think you've got a tabletop Coleco collection, and then one dude he sent me all the box ones, like, right. It was yesterday in America. Again, it's different territories, you know, us buying those, you know, it's relatively hard, and but still for him, he's got every single one boxed, you know, which was a tweet that GameSack did, and then he happened to see it. So this is this thing of, like, from one to the next, you then see what people are doing throughout the world, you know, with this hobby. I mean, retro gaming is just such a big subject.
Grown as well, wasn't it? It's you know, really exploded
over
the past 10 years, I'd say.
I mean, it's a complex subject, really. It's like, how has it developed? I think it's... You know, it could be 101 reasons why it's so popular, from YouTube, obviously social media. I think legacy, obviously I work in licensing, we'll come to Numbskull in a minute. Legacy IPs, which are so popular, both in the, not just the gaming space, but the movie and the TV space, have made it more mainstream, I suppose you could say. And also that, you know, publishers are kind of using their content as a means to re-energize and reinvigorate some of those titles, because gamers love seeing their kind of childhood characters, like, reinvigorated. You know, it's always a tight balancing act. You know, are you going to do the right job with the next Sonic movie, or, you know, Shinobi, if that comes out on the PS5, is it going to spoil the Japanese Mega Drive version? But that's also interesting conversation and content as well for us lot, you know. I think that's why it's popular. But I think social media has really been the most important kind of aspect of its kind of popularity, really.
It's amazing, really, and you've done very well with games you've loved. So how did Numbskull come about? And how long has it been going now? Because it's been around for a good few years now.
Yeah. So Numbskull was started up. So it's coming up. Well, it's actually 11 years now, I believe. So it's
11 years already.
Yeah. So September 2012, does that make it? Yeah. It was started up by Ben Grant and Matt Precious. So two people just started the business up, business partners. And key sort of vision was, I mean, you know, Rubber Road is the holding company. You might have heard Rubber Road because Numbskull is got Numbskull Games, obviously Numbskull Designs. It's kind of Dare to Imagine. So it's, you know, very much we are a design business, you know, creating merchandise that they wanted to buy themselves, I think, in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So they'd worked in the games industry for many years, and they felt that they could bring to the table merch that was iconic, but in some cases quirky, very collectible, and something that they would want to, you know, put on the shelf genuinely and sort of own for themselves as, you know, as fans of TV, movies and video games. And they're the three core areas we kind of work in. So, I'm trying to think of some of the first projects that you might have sort of seen, but the Street Fighter t-shirts were quite an early thing for Numbskull. I also did key rings, quite faint, you know, like the different PS4 key ring, and then the Master System, Mega Drive. I mean, we literally produce hundreds of products every year of all shape and form, from figurines, statues, our tubs, which you might be familiar with.
Yeah, I've got a few of those in the background. They are back there somewhere. Obviously, I've got some Numbskull quarter-cade machines.
Quarter arcades.
I've got Ghostbusters light up there, which I believe is a Numbskull product.
Yeah, I expect it is, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, like you say, it appeals to someone like myself.
That's the idea, isn't it? I mean, we want to create something that fits our gamers who are really into the subject, but also people who just want some kind of attachment to the character or the IP. And it might be some people might have just one Numbskull product, you know, say it's a quarter arcade on their desk or a lamp, through to people who literally have, there's a guy called Vincenzo who has every single tub. You know, we're talking about, we're now at 250 different tubs, and he has every single one, which is just amazing.
Must be running out of shelf space.
But also with him, it's like he knows probably more about these characters than us. You know, he's just so massively into it. Same with the quarter arcades. You know, again, we've got people who have, you know, I've got obviously a few. I can see some in your background, but they've got that, and then they've got the, you know, they've made their own sort of set. You know, some of them, we've got our own wallpaper and
carpet. I was going to say, you even do the carpet, don't you, now as well?
But some of them literally have, you know, it's like an arcade doll's house, two stories, you know, lights. It's pretty fantastic to see. And I think that's, again, that harks back to the games you love thing. I mean, I'm nearly 50, literally, coming up. I am just like a kid.
Yeah, same here. I'm 48, and you know, our viewers can't see this obviously, but I'm surrounded by arcade machines and CRT screens. There's all Transformers and He-Man stuff, and pretty much, you know, my childhood is around me still, and I love it.
Exactly. I always remember one of my favorite movies is Big with Tom Hanks.
Yeah,
and I always thought maybe I could be him when he's older, but just me. And funnily enough, that's what led me to Numbskull, really. So about 5 years ago, I'd been reviewing Numbskull products through Games You Loved over the years, kept in touch, particularly with Ben, but I had, you know, had sort of seen Matt as well, and weirdly we were in the same building. I was working for a tech startup, and one thing led to another, and he talked to me about these quarter arcades, and it was something they'd been working on for, I mean, 5 years, about 7 years ago really. And he said, look, you know, you've got 20 years of marketing experience. I was looking for a move, and it just so happened that my first project was to launch the Pac-Man quarter arcade cab, which is like a dream to me.
Mm.
Working with Namco, worked with Lee Curtin back then, who was the chief Pac-Man officer. And, working on Pac-Man as your first product launch was...
no pressure, you know, there.
Was, no pressure, but equally was really exciting. I launched it at London Play Expo. They had a London Play Expo. We had a stand there with the machines. Lots of interest from, you know, influencers, customers, and we took it out. I think you came to one of our get-togethers as well.
A few months later, I met
you there, and people just really into them, you know. And that was a journey in itself, because I think it's kind of interesting with what we're going to talk about with the book is that we have this sort of obsession, I suppose, at Numbskull, especially with the quarter arcades, about, you know, trying to create the most authentic product as possible, and you know, not really accepting second best. So we might not be the quickest out of the gate in terms of sometimes from launch to delivery, but you know, I think our fans appreciate the, you know, what they're getting at the end.
Yeah.
To be able to you know, sort of have something that, that they would genuinely want in their room, you know.
Well, I think the Space Invaders machine's a good example of that.
Yeah,
it's obviously it's been in the works for ages, but
true.
What is coming looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that is you know, that's like being in Geppetto's where his workshop. It's just chip away. I think you know, we've had several prototypes to get this thing as close to the original as possible.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're using modern materials, but the, you know, we're using obviously the Pepper's Ghost effect. You know, the UV light, which is coming in on a recent one, to get the ambience just, you know, as close as we can. Move, you know, moving the screen, the game down, so it's close to the original as possible. It's been an interesting process to get us there, but we're really happy. It's been sent to Nishikado. He's actually seen it because we've had some signed versions as well through Taito. And yeah, we're in a place now where next month we're hoping to have them delivered, really. So
cool.
All systems go.
So it's nearly there.
Nearly there, yeah. And then Turtles will be the next one after that.
Yeah.
The two Turtles cabs, Turtles in Time and the arcade.
Again, looks great.
Yeah.
Attention to detail's been paid.
It has, with four players on one machine, which we've managed to sort of squeeze us all in on the joystick. When I first saw that machine, I thought, oh, it is simply the USB, because you can play USB controllers.
Right.
But it was like, no, they all work. And I was like, wow, that's interesting.
All squeeze around it.
But when we managed to do it, I think it's EGX, we took them last year. It is humanly possible with adults, but I'm sure kids can do it quite easily.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can do two and two if you so wish, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're the next, I guess you could call them tabletop arcade games, which might be a good segue into what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, this what this main chat is about really is this book that you guys are publishing, which is called From Coin Op to Tabletop. Now,
right.
I did ask the other guys on the podcast to do this, and they all said, "Dean, really, this is more suited to you," because and they were right, and you know, I was just busy, but I've had a love for these things. I've actually got a red label.
Is that a Galaxy Invader 2 or Astro Wars?
Astro Wars, yeah.
Okay.
So all of these are right up my street. The very first one I got was Invader. I've got – my cousin had this one, so I ended up picking this one up.
Okay, yeah.
I've only had this one a couple of years, but, yeah, CGL.
While we're sitting here, can we just Not flexing, but we can just
go for it, mate, because I know you've got a lot more than what I have. Yeah, Chris is showing me exactly the same what I'm holding.
Isn't it strange?
Even
you connect, but it's nice, isn't it? It's the fact we've kindred spirits.
And I've done this before on the podcast, and prepare your ears, listeners, but it's the sound on these things as well. You know, that to me, that's more nostalgic than even the PlayStation start-up sound effect.
It's funny, I was at an event on Saturday, I turned Astro Wars, and this lady, it's almost like I see tears in her eyes. Like, it was childhood.
It
brought it all back for her. It was kind of, she said, I haven't heard that sound for like 30 years.
Hmm.
You know, and I think that is part of this as well. You know, the kind of nostalgia. There's a lot to the kind of book, because they are a very weird set of games, these ones. You know, that this is the first book that's purely dedicated to tabletop electronic games alone.
Yeah.
There are books with both that include tabletop electronic games. There's a good book called Electronic Plastic, which is, I think, a Japanese. I own it somewhere. It's right. hidden. And it's I bought that many years back. And there's a few others.
This is the first one to actually fully focus on.
Fully focus, yeah. And it's an interesting debate of what is tabletop, you know, what defines that. You could handheld this, but I would probably, because it's got a joystick on it, more likely to have it, you know, sort of flat down. Certainly the Coleco ones.
One of these, which I weren't sure whether you, I don't know if you remember these.
My goodness.
Black Belt by GT Action, or nice. Action GT.
So now I'm getting FOMO because I haven't seen that before.
You haven't? Oh, well, no. This, basically, you got the guy there. It's a karate figure on this plastic brick, basically, and there's lights around him, and they make a sound effect, and each time it lights up, you have to move one of his limbs, so he's like punching or kicking.
Okay.
And
wow.
It just speeds up, you know. It's,
I think Action GT, they were a British business, were they? Like,
yeah,
Ideal?
I believe so. Yeah, they were obviously importing these. And
I've never seen that before.
Rebranding them slightly. Yeah, I've actually got a couple of them, but one of them's missing the battery cover. I can send you that one if you want to.
Well, why not? I mean,
handhelds
and tabletops is my thing.
Yeah, it's your thing.
Not as much as a Collector Faye from Kingdom of Cards. She has got an insane number of handhelds. Like, I think it must be veering towards 1,000. All retro, not Game Boys, but, you know, things like Tiger weird little, I mean, I've got a fair few sort of weird handhelds, but the Tigers, she's got so many of them, and that's a book in itself, to be fair.
Oh, I can imagine. So how did this book come about? Was it because you've got a big interest in these? We've known about that for a while. Was it the author came to you, or did you seek someone out, or what?
So Matt, who owns, so it's Matt and Ben. Matt is the is kind of on the creative production side. We've just talked about these for years. Weirdly, I'll just hold it up, the old Tomy Turning Dashboard.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a classic. So he had this as a kid. I actually have some spare, so I sent him one. For some reason I got five of them, but
just
keep picking them up. And then it was the old Astro Wars. So we've been chatting about this for probably about 3 years now. And we, again, sort of had this thought of, you know, there isn't any love for these, particularly these tabletop games. They pop up now and again, I think, on social media. I think they have been sort of re-energized occasionally, like somebody's tried to remake them. So we just thought, you know, dedicated... I guess archive a book would be a really nice piece to do. We haven't gone down the books avenue previously. I mean, this is a bit of an experiment for us, to be honest.
Because it's a Kickstarter project, isn't it?
It is a Kickstarter, And it's a very niche and very much a place in time, these tabletops.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I was asking some of the people at work who are about 40, they don't remember them. Even that age, you know.
That's mad because, like you say, Tiger, they wasn't the greatest of games. Towards the late 80s, you know, when they'd done Double Dragon and Afterburner and Outrun and Golden Axe and whatever, they weren't great. But for me, like I say, I'm 48 and I think I probably had these before I got my Atari. My Atari, I think I got around 1984. I was quite late to it. Stuff like, you know, Invaders 1000 and Astro Wars and Firefox F7. This was gaming to me.
Yeah.
My first console was a Binatone.
Okay.
Which was so simple, you know, you soon got bored of it. But these were great Christmas presents, I felt. And when I got them, you know, you was hooked to them for ages. So it's strange that people have forgotten about them.
I think
don't even know about them.
No, I think I mean this one here. You can see this is the Space Invader. I mean the licensing part of the book is hilarious because the amount of sort of sidesteps they did around the licensing, it was renaming is an interesting part of the the actual narrative, because you had things like, I mean, Pac-Man got the most of variants, Munchman.
Yeah. Munchman, which I've got here.
Yeah, so we're showing off our tabletops now. that was done, Grandstand did a lot of games like that, particularly, I think. I think Grandstand, from memory, were kind of New Zealand and British business. But they were massive in the UK between the particular, time and space. But talking about the timings, I mean, things like Demon Driver, I think that was 1978.
I was going to say, I remember that one at primary school, a lot of the kids had it.
Yeah. So if you were like me, so I'd have been 5 when that came out. Mm. Somebody of 55 would have, so the age thing really has a lot to do with these. And the other thing, kind of the two things that were interested about this particular genre, should we call it, was that it existed really within about a 10-year window, I think, maybe 76-ish. But by about 1988, it was the death knell before the Game Boy came out and just completely killed these off, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But also, Game & Watch was...
Even Game & Watch, yeah. Yeah,
One I had was the Super Mario Brothers one.
Yeah, but also the consoles as well. You had home consoles. I mean, the title of this, Mike, so I'll come on to Mike Diver in a minute, who's a big fan of it. He's obviously, he's not just there writing for us. the coin ups to tabletops is the story, because when you think about, all of these, a lot of these are ports.
Yeah,
they are ports from the arcade to, some regard as plastic hell, but also, I think it's a little mini statue of an arcade machine.
They're great. The Coleco ones, I remember seeing a couple of them when I was a kid, but they didn't seem to be as popular over, the Americans, when you look on YouTube, they seem to have access to loads of those, and I remember seeing a couple when I was a kid. Were they released generally over here, or was it?
I think they had some sort of release through, I think, some sort of high street stores, but I've never seen them in like an Argos or an Index or a Littlewoods catalogue, which is what you saw Grandstand of. The places AVGN has them in his background, James Rolfe. Yeah. Yep. Famously, I remember them appearing in Gremlins, the movie. There's a scene in that. Also in National Lampoon's, there's a scene in that where he's playing, I think it's Pac-Man. So they're definitely, they're also in an episode of Magnum PI. In fact, they were in a few episodes of Magnum PI, I think.
Really? I'll have to keep an eye out for those.
I think there's a Pac-Man, another sort of Pac-Man machine. So, definitely the Coleco are more American, US, Canadian orientated, maybe even Australian as well.
Mm.
So, there are some geographical divisions, but differences. Because the US audience hasn't seen Grandstand. But I think, again, they're fascinated, like we're fascinated with Coleco. I mean, I own a Zaxxon. The Sega Zaxxon Coleco, and that's a monster beast, and I want to own it because, like, we didn't get stuff like that. We were getting things like Firefox and Astro Wars, but didn't really get much bigger than that,
Yeah. What happened to CGL? Because they worked with Nintendo on the game, or at least they released them over here for Nintendo.
I think it was a distribution.
They were based in South Woodford, weren't they, in East London? And Loughton, I think I saw an address for once.
Yeah, so I've got the original ball here, which was Computer Games Limited, South Woodford. You're absolutely spot on. Yeah. And they were a distribution brand, I believe. Yeah. I don't know an awful lot about them, but yeah, you definitely saw them on a lot of the electronic games of the time.
Yeah.
Especially, like you say, Game & Watches.
Pimp, you've got Ball there, haven't you?
Yeah.
That was the first one released, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know, because I think somebody's going to have me out on this one, but I have got a game somewhere called Toss Up, and I think it was the Japanese version of Ball.
Right.
So Wikipedia won't tell me otherwise, but I'm suspecting that came before, but I can't find any information on it. But yeah, in a nutshell, without getting too anal, yes.
I've got Pinball here, and it's got the address as Loughton on this one, so they must have had a couple of offices. But it was a name that during the early 80s, at least, it was everywhere, and then they just seemed to vanish, which was a bit strange.
I mean, similar to the arcade, I mean, this Galaxian here is Midway, the Frogger here is Sega. Equally, the Pac-Man is Midway. So the kind of license and distribution arrangements, I had a similar setup to the arcades.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, we're finding this out when we do our quarter arcades. Licensings are all officially licensed. We obviously pay for that.
Yeah.
Endorsement, and also the working with the teams. You know, you can get multiple licenses for one machine, for example. And it's the same for some of these. But as I say, some of them kind of sidestep some of that, which is kind of interesting. I don't know the stories behind it entirely, but Mike does touch on quite a lot of that during the book, really. So Mike Diver, I've kind of known Mike over the years from, I think, like, games you loved, really. Nintendo Life, Mike's written for. I also was at Gaming Bible. And I've just kind of got to know Mike and Darren, who I work with as well. And he's got a lot of this stuff, you know, a bit like us. I'm a bit older than Mike, but similar sort of era, if you like. And he's got from Tomytronics, he's got a lot of the box ones, the handhelds, through to, some of the tabletop. So, I just approached Mike some time back, and he was just like, yeah, I would love to get involved in this, because it's quite unique, something I'm really into, once I've got some knowledge of these games, I want to go deeper, which he's done. Just to say on the Kickstarter, Mike has written the majority of the book already, quite a large amount, because we want to, obviously looking for funding. When we get funded, with a bit of luck, we want to kind of progress forward. And Mike's done a good chunk of the work already. Yeah. All the game reviews and the ins and outs of the games in detail, from gameplay to the describing the actual hardware, because the product design of these things is insane, because each one's just, so different in terms of its shape, color. The other thing, which is very interesting about each game, is that a game such as, I'm trying to think of something like, say, Afterburner, porting on the Game Gear.
Yeah.
You're obviously doing an arcade game into, get this right, 8-bit, so it'd be Master System, wouldn't it, sort of port. You're taking Afterburner and trying to put it in a black and white LCD screen. How the hell do you do that?
This is it. How do you go about doing that? This is math, really, isn't it?
But yeah, I mean, if you wrote a brief for it now, you get sort of you get thrown out of the room for some of the stuff they come up with. I mean, I was just talking to Jason Bradbury about this, because we had a panel at Blackpool, and it was this point of, how did they convince how did the designer convince the toy maker to make something like Afterburner? Because it's 98% sort of joystick and plastic, and about 2% game,
Yeah.
The game is probably a smaller screen than a Tiger. that they justified, and they made Afterburner, they made Outrun, and they made Batman the game as well.
Yeah.
So it's truly, and he's involved, you know, sort of product of Ashens could make a really funny video.
Very humorous video, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I remember my disappointment with the Double Dragon.
Yeah,
I don't know what I was expecting. I think I played Double Dragon on the Game Boy, and I don't know why. I just thought maybe it will resemble that a bit, but no.
I think those, they're all part of the same history. Those Tiger and like the Double Dragon, that it was a sort of impulse buy that perhaps a relative would go out and buy.
Yeah,
Little Dean likes Double Dragon. Yeah. I'll buy him that thing he plays in the arcade. Little did they know that, you know, you're a fan of the arcade, not crap handheld games. That's what you got, you know. And it's sort of thing, I always remember like playing in a caravan or something in the wet, you know, sort of, and it was just trying to make the best of it.
I think with those ones, they came so late as well. I think by that time, the Game Boy had probably come out in Japan, maybe America, so we'd probably, you know, I played my friend's one that come from the States, and once you played those Tiger games especially seemed very dated before the, you know, as soon as they were released, whereas some of the older stuff, I think because they light up and they've got distinctive sounds, I think these have actually aged better than the later Tiger stuff.
It's good you come on to that because, you know, it wasn't all bad. I mean, Wars is a great version of Galaxian or Galaga.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, when you hear that sort of intro to Astro Wars, it's not just nostalgia. It's loud. It's, you know, in your face. It's like the arcade.
Yeah.
And play Astro Wars with the lights off. Just do that. And that's
an experience, isn't
it? It's a hell of an experience. Same with Firefox as well. That's another.
Yes, the sound on that I absolutely love. And that 3D effect, you know.
Definitely, yeah.
It's mad, really, what they did accomplish.
Another really good game, you know, it's because, like, it, you know, are there any games that are better than the arcade? Well, that's quite hard. But Tron, which is a Disney Tomy game, which is quite rare. I've got that one. That's got three different levels to it. It's a really interesting game because you get at the beginning the riding effect, and then you've got like a sort of disc, throwing the discs element to it. It's there's a lot to that very simple game on that tiny little sort of tabletop. So that again is, you know, is a decent port. I actually think Donkey Kong on the Coleco tabletop's quite a decent version. The music's really good as well, for what it is, you know. And then things like, I guess to precede things like Bop It, you had Simon, which is a hugely popular game, you know, of its time.
What this black belt is quite like, really, you know. It's just
but Simon,
similar things.
Simon, strangely, I'll just try to go back in the old cupboard here, was from Atari.
Touch Me.
Which, very strange name for a, for a game. They obviously just took the, I mean, it's got the colours and everything to it.
Yeah.
Just took that concept, rebadged it, and you had probably one of the most popular family games of the 70s and 80s. Very iconic as well. It's a bit like a Rubik's Cube, I think.
The
Simon, and I've got I didn't have a Simon. I had a Pocket Simon, which I still have my original. That was I was obsessed with that thing as a kid, thinking I was going to be some sort of, you know, Einstein by being able to do it, beat my brother playing that game. It was a bit of a classic. But there's also some obscure ones as well in the book, you know, as well as the most popular. It's kind of mixing the. Mixing them all up, really.
Is there a game that you're still after?
Like a Holy Grail
sort of thing?
Well, there's a few from what Matt's got in his collection, funnily enough. There was a Pengu, what he's got, which is a Sega arcade game.
Yeah.
It's just, because it's Japanese, it's just immaculate box. It's like it's come out of the factory. The game's okay, but just the machine just, you know, it's in the beautiful part. Condition. Yeah. There's also, sometimes I don't always go after the game. There's a game in this book called Safari, which is green. It's almost like a modern kind of trendy green, and it's a disc shape. Very, very simple game to play, but the actual unit, the hardware, is stunning. And again, it's condition. I mean, one of the things that the photographer, Chris, who's, you know, working on the book with all the original photography, because the other thing to say is that, you know, we're not lifting images from Google. We own these games. You know, we've just taken a large number of them to Play Expo. But Chris has shot them from loads of different angles. And this has never, again, been done before. We wanted it to be a bit like a car showroom for
really tabletops. Showing off.
Yeah, really
these,
showing
these
off.
These machines, yeah.
So giving them a lot of love. So they've all been cleaned. Like they've literally just come from the Argos catalogue, you know. There's a few little dinks here and there on them, you know, just their natural thing. But some of them are, you know, because we want it to really lift off the page. It's quite a hefty book in terms of size. It's a hardback. We're not doing a softback book, just a hardback book. So it's got some, so it's oversized USA 4. So it's quite a nice wide book in itself, really, to kind of tell the story. And then there's some other elements as well as the game reviews. You've got, there's actually a quite a big section about each of the companies. You know, a bit of history as the companies. There's also a piece about the technology, so, you know, VFD versus LCD and what that kind of means, because, you know, there's confusion, LED as well.
Yes, big time, yeah.
And also the kind of, you know, the sort of point of the evolution, you know, how they came about, you know, why the arcades inspired them. And, you know, kind of it's perhaps the end, the death knell of them, but the point that people are still very much collecting them. And I think this book's going to trigger some people to go back on eBay.
Make the prices maybe. Right.
That's not part of the deal. But,
no, of course
I must
not.
Admit, I'm kind of – I've been looking a little bit myself. I was at London Game Market and I was close to – picking up a couple of things, but I think a few cavemans got sold over the weekend as a result of us being there.
It seems to be quite a popular one. It
definitely,
seems to see
that
quite often, yeah.
Yeah, it's got a ditty little tune to it, that one. But yeah, that was, again, Grandstand, and they made a few different form factors off the same shape. So it's Tron, I think Alien Attack, which is Scramble. So they made a few different versions of Scramble, but just kind of renamed it occasionally. But, you know, you found that things like Space Invaders and Scramble and Pac-Man, given the popularity of the arcade, they had lots of guises within the tabletop arena. So we have got some, you know, like Pac-Man's covered in a few different shapes, from Munchman to Puckman to Coleco's Pac-Man. So that's quite a nice thing to, you know, to kind of see the different shapes of the tabletops, as well as the games being quite different, because the Munchman's more landscape, weirdly. It's kind of playing across the screen.
It's a strange one. Whereas obviously, he goes backwards as well, doesn't he, when you move left.
Exactly.
The other way round, one of the two.
So I think, you know, probably, you know, there's some people who just collect Pac-Man, you know, memorabilia, and I'm sure that Munchman and Coleco's Pac-Man is probably part of quite a lot of those collection. They also made a smaller sort of oblong version of it as well, handheld. It came in a silver box. I mean, you remember that one?
I think I do. Yeah, it rings a bell.
I stupidly collect those as well, so I've got most of those ones. I think that for me, a lot of this was definitely, I have kind of the two British, I know you've got a lot of you know, people all over the world, but for me, British shops were Woolworths, WH Smiths and Boots, where I used to get stuff like this from, you know. That's, you know, that's what I almost smell, the cardboard, when I think about, you know, picking up some of these games, you know, back in the day, so they say.
So nostalgic. Right, I'm going to ask you a question now, which is just pops into my head. Out of all these, is there any you'd like to see reproduced? You think they could be reproduced these days, or
do you mean with like our sort of latest VR technology, or just as they were?
I don't know. Maybe just genuine, you know, as they were, as close as possible.
I think if you had to say do a Astro Wars again, you would want to keep it the same, but maybe give it some enhancements. Because
yeah,
with respect, you know, you can go out and get an Astro Wars for £30 still. It's
true.
Not
yeah.
particularly expensive or rare. So commercially, you'd want to, you know, maybe sort of, I'm just really top of the head stuff here, but you know, maybe keep your high scores, because I don't think sometimes when you turn it on and off, maybe post them up to the internet. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure actually with that question.
I don't know why it just popped into my head. You know, I wonder if there would be a market for that.
I mean, if Sega did an Afterburner, but with a bigger, better screen, and it was the arcade version.
Yeah,
with stereo
the arcade
sound.
ROM.
Yeah, yeah, arcade ROM, stereo sound.
That would sell. That would sell loads.
That would be awesome. You know.
Yeah. Mini Outrun.
Well, this is the thing. If you had to sort of create a tabletop of 2023, it would have to be. I think they're all kind of arcade games, you know.
Mm.
So, I mean, a Time Crisis would be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
you're almost then into quarter arcades, aren't you?
Yeah, sort of. Nearly. Yeah, I guess so.
Do you know what I'm saying? I think quarter arcades are the tabletops.
Yeah, of the modern day.
If you make, cause it's like back then you couldn't even make a Pac-Man as good as, you know, not maybe I'm biased, but as good as we have created it in terms of the scale.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah.
So I think that's probably, sounds like I'm really like, cause I'm the marketing director of Numskull, bringing it back to that. But
no, it's something I could see Numskull doing, but.
but I think I think for me, what I like about these is kind of like why, aside from Numskull, but why I like going to an arcade, because it's a bit like putting a record on. Rather than flicking through lots of games, you're just there, head down, playing one thing.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of these tabletop games, you know, good or bad, whatever. And if you play it for 2 minutes and have a go, or if you're on Astro Wars for, you know, 20 minutes, I think it's that point of just cutting yourself off and playing one thing and one thing only is why I like these things still, really.
Yeah.
I think that, and I think, you know, if you could do that in a modern day sort of scenario, I mean, I suppose like one of my sort of favorite games is Tekken, you know. So if you could do like, say, not even quarter arcades, but kind of like a, maybe like a two-player.
Just in this kind of form factor, you know, where
factor,
they're a bit more boxy,
Yeah, a bit more sort of retro sort of looking could be fun, a fighting game maybe. If you could take the beat in, that is. I mean, you can have crazy stuff like R360s, but how are you going to get in there, you know? Sort of.
Yeah, that'd be mad.
But I think that's just the kind of, you know, not to keep too long, but, you know, could you do something like that, you know, now? You'd probably do it with VR, you know.
Mm.
But then is it the hardware? You know, maybe you could combine hardware and VR in some way. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, possibly.
You might have to have a few pints to explore that one.
Sad to think about. Right, so exactly. When does this Kickstarter end? When have we got to help fund it by?
Yeah, so it's over halfway funded now, which is fantastic. Cool. We've had over 450 backers as I look at it right now. And it finishes on Saturday, October 28th at 6:41 a.m. UK time, to be precise. So, yeah, Saturday the 28th of October.
Right, okay.
I'll best get
this edited then.
Yeah, no, it's all good. So, yeah, we've been very pleased, you know, with the support so far. But yeah, obviously get your, you know, if you're interested, get over to the Kickstarter page, from coin ops to tabletops, the essential electronic games. And yeah, you'll see us there, really.
Yeah, and you got a few more contributors to the book, haven't you? Like Ashens. And
yeah, there's a few
YouTubers.
People, yeah, some people that I reached out to who, you know, were very much into the subject matter. We didn't want somebody just coming on board if they, you know, perhaps played Astro Wars for 5 minutes. Stuart, particularly, I think he's, you know,
he's happy straight, isn't
over
he?
The years. Yeah, exactly. Jason Bradbury. He's really into the hardware, the tech. He's actually been a lecturer in actual product design. So he's really interested in the aesthetic as much as the games within. But he's loves retro from his personal hobby point of view. There's Retro Dodo Brandon. I met up with Brandon recently as well. I've been talking to Brandon about his book for a while. So Brandon's a younger guy, but he doesn't matter because he's just passionate about anything to do with retro gaming, and he loves nostalgic tech. John Hancock, I've known John for years actually. John's got an amazing collection. I mean, familiar with John, and he was just like he's into the Coleco. That's his kind of particular tabletop of choice, I think.
Yeah.
So he was keen to get involved, and then Peter, nostalgia nerd. Pete's done a fair few pieces on it. He's got a crazy collection as well of stuff that I don't know. He owns the Batman sort of game, which is like the Afterburner.
I think he'd done a video on
I think there's been a video on that, yeah. He's got the Outrun. He's got a fair few of it. He's probably got more than me, to be honest, in his stash. And then Dan, so I know Dan's really into Scramble, but he's got Astro Wars, Slopes Game Room. So we've got, about six contributors who are part of the book, really.
Cool. Nice. Well, we wish you the best of luck with it. And I'll be pledging, because, like I say, it's right up my street. I absolutely love these things, and it sounds, all of it sounds really good. Can't wait to read it. So fingers crossed it all goes fine.
Appreciate the support, Dean. And
worries.
Great to talk to you, because I know you got a thing for these things like me. So
It's been good to have you on the show as well, mate.
Cool. Yeah, definitely. It's been a pleasure.
Meaning to do it for a while. So thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good to see you, and thanks for having me on too.
No problem. No problem. Like I say, we wish you the best of luck.
Great stuff. Cheers.
Cheers, mate.
You're listening to Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
So there you go, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Chris Hill. Hopefully that Kickstarter will get funded, and the book should be out around April of 2024. So anyway, we'll be back soon. We're actually planning the Christmas episode of Retro Asylum behind the scenes as we speak. Some mad plans being thrown about for that, courtesy of Steve. Thank you, Steve. He's put me in a right situation, let me tell you. But it should be fun. So, it's all go at Retro Asylum. Anyway, until next time, guys, take care, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.